Vincent against the United Auto Workers and DSM Engineering. No problem, Mr. Yoakum. We can put that podium down, too, and see how far it will go down.
Just hit it again, it'll actually go down.
Down. Exactly. Thank you. Mr. Yoakum.
Yes. May it please the Court, Your Honors. You've identified me correctly, and I'm here to represent Kim Vincent, the appellant.
If you could raise your voice just a little, we would appreciate it.
I'm here to represent Kim Vincent, the appellant in this case. We are here basically because of the fact that the District Court sustained motions for summary judgment against Mr. Vincent. We believe that the standard of review in such cases is de novo. And as a result of the fact that there is a de novo review, we think that there is enough evidence in the record to require the matter be submitted for trial. The reason we say this is that in the record, the theory of the employer is that Mr. Vincent was terminated for absenteeism, relying, however, on a set of rules that was not in effect at the time that Mr. Vincent was discharged.
I thought the employer had in the record evidence indicating that it's always had some kind of chronic absenteeism policy. Maybe the words have changed a bit over the years, but the idea has been there, and that on top of that, Mr. Vincent himself had personally been both warned and at one point even suspended for failure to comply with it, and thus had personal acquaintance with what the employer's expectations were. Maybe you could address that.
Yes. Our problem with that, Your Honor, is that in the form of attendance and tardiness program in effect until 1998, the term chronic absenteeism was not only defined, but it was also said that the ordinary rules against or resulting in discharge or absenteeism would not apply.
Meaning that you might be discharged if you had less than the
seven point number.
Yeah, the 7 points.
Mr. Vincent had 5.5 points.
Right, but he knew he could still be discharged for chronic absenteeism.
Under this rule, now the rule in effect at the time of Mr. Vincent's discharge eliminates any inference to the exception to the ordinary rules. And it says, in effect, and this is why it's ambiguous and a jury could be allowed to, for want of a better term, analyze the thing or come to a conclusion about it, is that the policy in effect at the time only says prevent chronic absenteeism employees from being a hindrance to the operation of the plant. Take the necessary action. But it does not make an exception to the 7-point rule, which is very clear under the policy in effect prior to July the 1st, 1998. That's the reason we say that we can show under the theory that may not always be required, but the theory that the company violated the collective bargaining agreement. And I certainly don't...
How do we get to any of this without first concluding that the union violated its duty of fair representation?
Well, the duty of fair representation of the series of lies that Mr. Vincent was told. There are, he was told, one, that he had a good grief.
What does any of that have to do with the duty of fair representation? The only further thing the union could have done for the plaintiff was to take the case to arbitration. And I've taken it as fairly well settled that unions do not have a duty to take every employee grievance to arbitration.
No, they do not.
The negligent failure to arbitrate a case is
Don't they have a duty, Your Honor, under deciding cases that we cite in our brief at page 23, that they have a duty under Vaca versus Sipes to tell people the truth and be honest?
Vaca against Sipes is a very long time ago.
Yes.
The Supreme Court held in Steelworkers against Rawson in 1990 that negligent conduct by the union in failing to protect an employee's rights under a collective bargaining agreement does not violate the duty of fair representation.
This is not negligence. This man was told he did not have to testify at his arbitration hearing, which was...
But what's he lost if he had no right to an arbitration hearing anyway? I mean, it's not like it's laudable conduct to lie about that, but in terms of the representational aspect of what the union's doing, what...
Well, not only that, Mr. Vincent was told he had a good grievance.
Well, and he filed the grievance, and actually the union had helped him earlier, and then they make the decision, which is not communicated to him. No. Indeed, he gets inaccurate information, that they're not going to take this one to arbitration.
No.
But if that's a permissible decision, then why is his remedy against the union officials for whatever lies may have been told a 301 duty of fair representation action?
First plugs in the fact that if we take the company position to its logical conclusion that an old set of rules relating to absenteeism applies to a new set of rules, the company could also say we're paying a man $8 an hour under our new record, but we'll only pay him $7 now because it was in an old contract. Now, with reference to how that ties into the union's duty of fair representation, is simply this. If the union had looked at the rules that they had, they would have known that there was no specific definition of chronic absenteeism.
Well, but that's the problem. You're equating an error or a mistake or negligence or bungling by the union with a violation of the duty of fair representation. And Rawson expressly holds the contrary.
No, I'm not.
That what you have to show under Airline Pilots against O'Neill is essentially that the union was out to get Mr. Vincent.
Well,
they were on the outs with him because he was a political opponent of the incumbent union management, and that this was their chance to get back to him, and they took it, or something like that.
That doesn't seem to be the
kind of thing you're alleging.
May I read a quote from Bennett versus Local Union Number 88, a Seventh Circuit case decided in 1992? In which the court says that personal animosity then is not the sine qua non of a breach of the union's duty of fair representation. A union may not refuse to represent an employee for any improper reason of which personal animosity attests one. The precise reason is unimportant.
But you're not really saying they wouldn't represent him. You're saying after they decided not to take this grievance to arbitration, they failed to communicate that to him accurately.
Well, I'm saying eight things, Your Honor, which are, he was told that his grievance was going to arbitration. Okay. The grievance never went to arbitration. Vincent was advised that he did not need to be a witness at this arbitration. That an unfavorable unemployment compensation case would be used as evidence to support his position. That his grievance was dropped by the union, though he was told he had a good case. That he was discharged when he had 5.5 points, meaning he was not in violation of the policy in effect at the time he was discharged. In his 11 years at the employer, He was the only employee, according to Vincent and another employee, who was ever discharged who did not violate the point system in effect at the time he was discharged, and that he did not receive notice from the union that his grievance had been dropped until over a year after it had been dropped. Now, I don't want to sound righteous, but I think if you tried that before a jury of personnel directors, they would say that's not what a union should do, and particularly in light of the fact that the collective bargaining agreement says, okay, that they were not supposed to use a lot of the information of attendance to discharge him. It's in our brief that the collective bargaining agreement prohibits, just a minute and I'll read it because my memory is not that good. The collective bargaining agreement allows the company to retain the exclusive right to discharge people, but they have to have just cause. Just cause wasn't there. And then they say in an entry, an employee's record concerning disciplinary...
Thank you, Mr. Yochum.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. I apologize. And I didn't... I got it. But anyway, those quotes are at pages 2 and 3 of our brief showing the violations of the collective bargaining agreement. No, I'll get out of the way. It'll take me a second.
Switch is on the lower right side.
Pretty nice. Amazing. Speakers stand.
I often argued cases in the Supreme Court immediately before or after Robert Reich. You can imagine how much cranking was entailed in the podium there.
Pretty good. In response to the first thing that Mr. Yochum talked about regarding the policy, if you read the attendance policy carefully, it has basically five ways a person could be fired for unsatisfactory attendance. One is unreported absences. Two is late call-ins. Three is cumulative points. Four is five or more warnings for attendance. And the sixth one is, or the fifth one rather, is the chronic absenteeism.
This is the one you appended to your brief, dated July 1, 1998.
That's correct. And all along, the company has always had a reference to chronic absenteeism to try to catch these people who play the points game. And obviously, by implication, you have to have less than 7 points. Otherwise, you would have been fired under that policy. You can never have more than 7 points and still be working there. So this is designed to catch those people, just as the five warning thing is to catch those people who are always playing the attendance game with you. That's the whole purpose of it. And in this case, Mr. Vincent admitted that he knew what the policy was. He admitted he'd been counseled about the policy. He admitted that he had been talked to about it. He admitted that on more than one occasion, he admitted that the union on one occasion when he had been suspended pending termination had gotten his job back for him and he was given a last chance. And then he admitted that he was absent 11 more times. And so, you know, basically he admitted that he was an unsatisfactory employee because he wasn't at work, which is the first obligation of every employee. And I mean, I think we've established that we had good cause to terminate him, and this was a very justified discharge, and that defeats the first prong, and he has to prove both prongs, both that the union breached its duty of fair representation, which I don't think he can do, but Nora Macy will talk about that, and we've established that we had good cause to terminate him and thus didn't breach the contract. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Megan.
Yep.
Ms. Macy.
May it please the Court, I represent the International Union UAW and UAW Local 2074. In this case, the company and the union are on the same side. We are both...
Kind of makes you nervous, doesn't it?
It happens. We filed a joint brief for the first time in my 25 years of practice, so the court's admonitions on that point have finally sunk in. We are on the same side because there are two elements of the plaintiff's case, and those elements are the same with respect to both defendants. First element is that the employer must be proved to have breached the collective bargaining agreement, and the second element is that the union must be proved to have breached its duty of fair representation. Mr. Vincent's proof in this case is difficult because he must prove both elements and because the burden is on him with respect to both elements. Judge Young decided only one element of the case, and from our perspective, we thought the duty of fair representation issue is always the easier issue because of the extremely deferential standard under the Supreme Court decisions and decisions of this case. But I would suggest that the court could look at the factors that the union considered in deciding not to arbitrate this case as factors which also support the district court's decision that the termination was not in violation of the attendance policy and not in violation of the collective bargaining agreement. I think Mr. Vincent's proof in this particular case is difficult because the standard for chronic absentee is extremely deferential. Both the definitional section 1.02 of the attendance policy, it gives a very broad catch-all definition for chronic absenteeism, and the provision that Mr. McGann was referring to under corrective discipline, which is section 3.0 to 7.0 of the attendance policy. In section 7.0, it, unlike all the other bases for termination, it says chronic absenteeism is case by case, and in the disciplinary action, it basically says the company can do whatever is necessary. Unions generally don't like company discretion with respect to discipline. However, this is a battle that has been lost, and has been lost over the last, 15 years, in terms of the ability to apply no-fault absence control plans like this one. The local union did appeal this case to arbitration. In fact, they had requested a panel from the American Arbitration Association. However, the international representative, who was much more experienced in arbitration, much more knowledgeable about arbitration decisions, was the one who pulled this grievance and decided not to arbitrate it. And I would make a point that the international representative never made any misrepresentation to Mr. Vincent about the status of his grievance. It is on the record that before Mr. Vincent taped the local union president, who again is a $11 an hour in the plant worker, before he taped him in a kind of set-up conversation, he had already spoken to the international representative who had told him the grievance had been withdrawn, and he'd also already spoken to the vice president of the local union, who is the grievance chairman, who had told them that the grievance had been withdrawn. Four factors that led the union to withdraw the grievance, and these four factors are relevant to the district court's decision. One, language of the agreement. In spite of Mr. Yoakum's suggestions, there is no ambiguity in this language. Chronic absenteeism is set out as a separate basis. It would be a meaningless if you had to prove points for chronic absenteeism. And as Mr. McGann pointed out, points are relevant to only one of the five bases for discipline under the absence plan. Second reason, Mr. Vincent's attendance record. He had 11 absences in less than a seventh, just over 6 month period, and they were all or almost all close to a weekend. That evidence, that record is not disputed. Third, it's the arbitration policy. This is extremely significant evidence for a union representative making a decision whether to take a case to arbitration. This arbitration decision was the same plant, the same union, and the same country under a company under a predecessor name. And basically the issues that would have been raised in Mr. Vincent's arbitration were raised here. This is too discretionary, et cetera, et cetera. And the arbitrator basically said that these kinds of chronic absenteeism provisions serve an important policy and that the company has the right to enact them and enforce them. And then the fourth point, which was extremely significant to the union, is the issue of warnings. In the prior arbitration decision, the arbitrator made it clear that you could have such a policy, but that the employee had to be put on notice that he may be disciplined or terminated for the policy before it can be enforced. In this case, the international representative was involved the year before in a suspension pending termination. The company expressed its intent to terminate Mr. Vincent at this time. The union was able to persuade the company to give him one more chance. There has been some suggestion in the plaintiff's brief that the plaintiff didn't know, you know, what would be the consequence of this, but the deposition citations in the joint brief filed by the company and by the union show that he knew that he was being disciplined, suspended for chronic absenteeism, not points, that he knew that the problem was absences around a weekend, and he knew he could be fired for it. Finally, with respect to the misrepresentations, we do not say that that was proper union conduct. There's nothing in the record to suggest that it was caused by hostility or by any intent to harm Mr. Vincent. The individual, the local union president, put in his own affidavit. He was having serious health problems, serious family problems, and he was simply confused and mistaken. He admitted to the wrongdoing. It was corrected as soon as other people in the union knew about it.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until next Monday. Your time has expired.